There's so much I could say about the poet, philosopher, king of many rivers, my dear friend of over 35 years now. So Jim Wilson has done many things related to philosophy in his life. The philosophical practice of being a Zen monk for 6 years, study of philosophy in hot and warm climes, Arizona and Alaska, mm-hmm. both beginning with A, I just realized. He has written books that bring a philosophical perspective to spiritual practice and vice versa. And I am delighted to hear him talk tonight about Plotinus, a philosopher with whom I am unfamiliar, even though I've certainly heard the name plenty and read of him. So this is a wonderful opportunity for me, and I hope for you also. Please join me in welcoming Jim Wilson.
Thank you. Let's start with just a few minutes of silence. Jeff and I are sharing atmospheric response here. Thank you very much for coming tonight. It's wonderful to see all of you. I started with a couple minutes of silence because I thought it was fitting for Plotinus. Because the highest ideal that Plotinus talks about is, he calls it the One. Right? And he also calls it the Good, the Beautiful, the True, the Eternal. But it actually is ineffable. So all of those names are sort of next to it, but they're not the actuality of it. And then out of this one emanates all of existence. And silence, in silence, we come closer to the one. So that was the connection I was making. We'll talk more about this. I am not a scholar of Plotinus. I enjoy reading Plotinus, and I've read him over the years. If people have questions or comments or observations to make, please feel free at any point during this talk to do so. Plotinus lived from 205 to 270, so 3rd century late Roman Empire. He was born in Lycopolis, Egypt, which is near Alexandria. He was a Greek-speaking Egyptian, as far as we can tell. And Greek was the language of the Roman Empire at that time. We think of Latin as the language of the Roman Empire, and there's good reason for that. But the international language, the language of trade, the language actually of the common people, was actually Greek, particularly in Egypt and in that region of the Mediterranean. Plotinus was, we actually know very little. The only reason we know he was born in Lycopolis is because somebody who knew him found out that he was extremely reluctant to talk about his biography because he was a Platonist, and he regarded this world as reflections and images of the ultimate. He said, why should I talk about reflections of reflections? That kind of attitude. He went on a spiritual search as a young man in Alexandria. Alexandria was a ferment, a crossroads of every kind of spirituality you can imagine. Hermetica, Christianity, Judaism, every form of paganism you can possibly imagine. And interestingly enough, there were present in Alexandria Upanishadic and Buddhist teachers as well. He was very dissatisfied with the people he ran into, and a friend of his, when Plotinus was 28, recommended a teacher by the name of Ammonius Saccas. And he went to listen to Ammonius and was enamored of his teaching. And I think he stayed with Ammonius for something like 20 years. I think that's roughly right. Ammonius Saccas is a very interesting figure. He was hugely influential, and he wrote nothing. he had, among his students were both Christians and pagans. And both Christians and pagans claim Ammonius Saccas as theirs. Eusebius, for example, says that Ammonius Saccas was a Christian. Plotinus himself was a pagan, philosopher. But from all indications that I've read, Ammonius Saccas had Jews and pagans and Christians and Platonists, of course, in his school. When he was in his late 40s, it's not clear why he left Alexandria. Possibly Ammonius Saccas died, or his school came to a close. I'm speculating, though. We really don't know. But he wanted to visit India via Persia, and he had an opportunity to do this by joining the military expedition of the Emperor Gordian in 243. Like the same Gordian of the Gordian Knot. And but the Emperor Gordian was assassinated by his own generals, like in Persia, and so the expedition came to an end. The generals were not interested in going to India, thank you very much. And so Plotinus was there, you know, like sort of on his own. He made his way back to Antioch, and from Antioch he made his way to Rome, so where he settled in 245. There in Rome, he set up his own philosophical community. It's unclear to me, he must have had a reputation already, because he set up he put out his shingle and attracted students. On the other hand, philosophical schools were widespread in the Roman Empire at that time, you know, like from one end to the other, you know, like. According to, there are three biographies of Plotinus. One, the most interesting one. The others are extremely short and probably not reliable. But his student Porphyry wrote an extensive biography of Plotinus after he died. So we actually so we have some good information from a close student of Plotinus about his Roman period. And according to Porphyry, what he did was he lectured on Plato and on Ammonius, his teacher. Now, Plotinus considered himself a Platonist. He was affiliated with the Platonic school of philosophy. So it's good to remember that Platonism was by that time 600 years old. Was pervasive in the Roman Empire. At that time it was, it was Platonism defined the terms, set the language. If you read Philo of Alexandria, the great Jewish scholar, he uses the Platonic vocabulary. If you read Justin Martyr, he uses the Platonic vocabulary. And of course Platonists use Platonic vocabulary. If you read Celsus, the pagan philosopher, he uses the Platonic vocabulary. So Platonism was the structure and that the Roman Empire, that all the various factions in the Roman Empire actually shared this. Now, when Plotinus was in his 50s, in about 255, he began to write down his teachings. And up until that time, he did not write anything. My intuition is that he was following in the steps of his own teacher, Ammonius, who did not write anything. So there are certain implications for us about the fact that he didn't start writing until he was in his 50s. And that is that you do not get the kind of development of thought in his writings that you see in other philosophers who wrote, you know, much earlier in their life. So Plato is a very good example. There's a definite development and change of opinion in Plato when you go from his early dialogues to his later dialogues. There are, for example, three huge political dialogues of Plato: the Republic, the Statesman, and the Laws. And his views about politics really change, as you move from, from one dialogue to another. And that reflects Plato's experience in life, and how that manifested in his understanding of the relationship between the individual and the state. But you don't really get that with Plotinus. By the time he starts writing things, these issues have been very much gone over in his own mind. So he's really writing down really his final his final understanding, you know, by the time he begins writing, which I find that interesting, you know, like by itself. So in 263, Porphyry joins his community. So Porphyry became a major disciple of Plotinus fairly quickly. One of the interesting things about Porphyry is P-O-R-P-H-Y-R-Y. Porphyry is discusses the process whereby someone became a student of Plotinus. It's very interesting. And there was a kind of this open exchange of discussion. Porphyry describes an example where he disagrees with the conclusion that Plotinus has. So Plotinus' response is to set up a dialogue between one of Plotinus' students and Porphyry, and they go back and forth writing essays and reading them to the group, you know, like, and until Porphyry reaches a point where he comes into agreement, you know, like, but there was no, it was a dialectical process, you know, like, I find that a really interesting feature of the way that he taught. You know, he didn't take Porphyry aside and say, look, I thought about this a lot. And he actually had a student have the discussion, you know, with Porphyry about this particular issue.
So there was a discussion, or was it essays?
They were essays that were read aloud and then discussed by the community as a whole.
It's just interesting because Plotinus didn't write anything down.
Right.
But he had his students write.
Yeah, that is interesting. I hadn't thought about that. But by that time, 263, by that time he evidently had shifted in his view of writing and how to use it. According to Porphyry, incidentally, Plotinus was had extremely bad eyesight and was a terrible writer and made all sorts of grammatical mistakes and spelling errors and this kind of thing. I have a theory about that. You know, in Britain, it's C-O-L-O-U-R, and in America, it's C-O-L-O-R. You know, like, I've wondered ever since I read that by Porphyry whether the Greek that Plotinus used reflected an Egyptian spelling, dialect, and that sort of thing, whereas Porphyry, who came from Rome, you know, had a different, you know, one. Just an idea, but
it's another factor I think too is that at that time rhetoric was considered the highest form of knowledge, and it was spoken.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then writing was, if they wrote stuff down, it was to help notes for their speech. But their
right.
Speech was really the.
What Porphyry did was collect the essays of Plotinus, and so we owe the survival of Plotinus's essays to Porphyry, right? And he collected them and topically arranged them into six groups of nine essays each. Hence they are called the Enneads. Enneads means nine. So six groups of nine essays, all right. And this is the writing, this is it. You know, this is Plotinus' writings. And Porphyry also recorded the chronological order in which they were written. In the biography, he has the arrangement, the topical arrangement, and then he also lists the chronological arrangement, so that you know what was written first. Some people believe that you can detect an evolution in Plotinus's thought by reading them chronologically. Guthrie is a scholar who holds that position, or held that position. Most scholars do not find that to be the case, so you are free to investigate that on your own. I didn't find it to be the case. I didn't find reading them chronologically revealed anything of any change or any shift of focus. You know, like, but Plotinus had intestinal problems according to Porphyry, for most of his life, and he refused to take any medication which was animal based because he was a very committed vegetarian. And in his old age, in his late 60s, this got considerably worse. And it reads to me like he either had a stroke or he had some kind of trembling disease, you know, progressive disease. And he spent his last maybe year under the care of a doctor at an estate, and he passed away at the age of 70. A little bit about the community of Plotinus. It's actually very interesting. Porphyry gives us a good portrait of the community. First of all, it encompassed all strata of society. There were men and women. There were lower class people. We had some senators who were, you know, like interested, and there were children there. You know, like, isn't that interesting? I mean, your image of a philosophical community usually doesn't include children. The way children ended up in the home of Plotinus was, there were people died of plagues and other diseases much more frequently in the Roman Empire than they do in our modern medical system. And in several instances, couples who died left their children under the care of Plotinus. And he took this duty very seriously. He was very dedicated to these children and made sure that they had a good education and that they had opportunity to, you know, advance. And he didn't consider it, according to Porphyry, he didn't consider it like an interruption or a drag on his teaching, or that kind of thing. He really, accepted them in the community. They were part of it. You get the impression that his community was like an extended family, except that they weren't blood relatives, if that makes sense. And it's also, Plotinus' school, philosophical schools at that time were what we think of as spiritual schools. The primary purpose was to create a base for a philosophical way of life. And a philosophical way of life consisted of certain commitments that members would make. I mentioned vegetarianism. Plotinus was a serious and dedicated vegetarian, and his student Porphyry wrote a treatise on refraining from animal food. And it's in the form of a letter to a philosopher who has fallen away from that commitment. So you really understand that from the Plotinian point of view, it was expected that you would live a certain, what we would call, lifestyle, that was a part. Now, we don't have a manual of what those commitments were. We don't know whether they were initiated into those commitments, whether there was a ceremony, we do not know how that was done. It's one of our big gaps. We know that they, and it wasn't just Platonists, Stoics, Epicureans, they also had these kinds of commitments. Porphyry briefly mentions that on the birthday of Socrates and Plato, the Plotinus would they had an offering, done to those two ancient sages and founding masters of their tradition. But exactly what did that ritual consist of? Did they chant? Did they offer incense? Did they ring gongs? Did they sing? We just have these tantalizing sort of, fragments that's left over, but we don't know, we can't flesh out exactly what was going, what life with Plotinus was like. But I think it's important for us that when we read the Enneads, they were given out to students when they were ready and advanced enough to read them and discuss them. You know, like, according to Porphyry, you know, like, certain people, you know, would be given them at certain times. You know, like, it's very interesting. And once again, we don't know what the basis of that was. You know, like, what was the signal that you were ready? You know, like, or, you know, like, how, did you have to be there a certain number of years? Did you, how did that work?
Do you think you don't know because it also might have been considered secret? Like, you know, you don't know much about Pythagoras' school because it was considered secret. Do you think that?
In some cases, I think that is correct. You know, for example, the mystery traditions are the best example of that. And they were so effective at keeping their secrets that we literally don't know. I mean, nobody broke, you know, like the vow of secrecy. In Plotinus, I'm a little skeptical about that because there's an essay in here called Against the Gnostics. You know, like, it's a critique of the Gnostics, who were contemporaries of Plotinus at that time. And one of his critiques is their secrecy and their, you know, like, and their elitism. You know, like, so if that was a criticism he had of that approach, then I'm not sure how that fit, you know, with his own teaching. So I'm just offering that as suggestive that perhaps Plotinus was not an esotericist himself.
A lot of Hellenistic history was lost because of the Middle Ages, and it was considered, you know, unchristian, pagan. And we know that the reason we know about Plato and all is because all the writings went to North Africa and were translated into Arabic, actually, and were lost in the Dark Ages in the West. So I think that's probably more than likely what happened to a lot, and some of the things that made its way through were just by happenstance they made it through.
So that's a little bit about Plotinus's life. You know, like, I think it's good to have that background. He led a fairly undramatic life, with the exception of his adventure with the Emperor Gordian. You know, like, so I want to give, what I'm going to do is talk a little bit about the basic structure of Plotinus's thought, and then I'm going to discuss one of his Enneads, one essay, the essay on the beautiful. So go from the general and then, you know, down to something specific. The Enneads cover a huge range of topics. Plotinus' style is not easy. He was a dense writer, and he's capable of being analytical in the sense of what moderns mean by analytical. Like, one of his Enneads is a critique of Aristotle's 10 categories of existence. And it's an extended critique, and it's what you would expect from an analytical philosopher, you know, like. On the other hand, he's capable of flights of ecstatic beauty, you know, like when he's talking about the one, for example, and when he's talking about beauty itself, you know, like. And so so you get a huge range of modes of expression. That's one of the difficulties. You sort of have to be open to the fact that he's not necessarily going to be consistent in his style as he moves from topic to topic. You know, like, the other difficulty is that, as I mentioned, Plotinus considered himself a Platonist, an inheritor of the 600-year-old tradition. And when he wrote his Enneads, he wrote it for an audience which was thoroughly familiar with the dialogues of Plato. And the works of Aristotle, and the commentarial tradition, particularly on Plato's dialogues. And we are not. So sometimes you can tell that he's making a reference to something, or he'll refer to a dispute, you know, like, but we don't know, you know, like, what the dispute was, you know, like, but it's that heritage, that history, and his audience would have known right away, you know, like who took which side and who took. The other thing about Plotinus' style, which I'll just put out for you, is that he had a way of writing which I find very interesting. Like he'll state a certain point of view, and then he'll go, you know, some people think X about that, you know, and really that's an interesting way of looking at it. Let's take a look at X, you know, and then he'll go on for a page and a half exploring that. And then he'll say, but you know, I don't really think that's adequate because of why. You know, like, and what I like about that is that he doesn't just dismiss someone's point of view, he really opens up the other person's point of view and lays it out for you. You know, like, but as a reader, what happens is that sometimes you get a little confused about whether Plotinus is talking about his own point of view or another person's point of view, and you sort of have to pay attention to when he's doing that kind of shift. It's not always easy to detect. So Plotinus didn't think of himself as a Neoplatonist. That's a later historical interpretation of Plotinus. But because he was so influential, and because his interpretation of Plato had a huge and lasting influence, and subsequent developments in Platonism in the late Roman Empire, in Christianity, and in Judaism, and in Islam, all reflect Plotinus' view of Plato. Historians of philosophy now think of Plotinus and post-Plotinian Platonism as Neoplatonism. So think of concentric circles. All right, so in the center you have the one. All right. And he calls it by a lot of different names. The one is the most frequent. He calls it the good, the beautiful, the eternal, the source. You know, like, it is completely ineffable. It is beyond description. It is beyond any affirmation. It is beyond any negation. You know, like, strictly speaking, no name can be applied to it. So, and then the first circle after the one is the Greek word is nous, nous, okay. And it's usually translated or often translated as intellect. Okay. It has also been translated as spirit. Okay. It's a hard word to translate. I tend to think of it as the intelligible. So in the center you have that which is beyond all intelligibility. And the first ring out, the first emanation, is the first hint of that which is intelligible or accessible to the human mind. Like so. So, occasionally, Plotinus refers to it as the one many. Okay. So it's the reason it's the first emanation of the intelligible is because it is no longer the one. It has parts, and that's why we can understand it. Okay. Because that's the way the human mind works. All right, so. It is the realm of pure forms. That's where Plato's pure forms reside. You know, like it is. it is the realm of numbers, those kinds of pure ideas. You know, like, and then after the one, after nous, nous. Okay. Then you have the soul, which is individuated. It's more individuated than the intelligible. right? And everything in existence, in Plato's view, has a soul. I just finished reading a section where he defends the idea that plants have soul, for example. Right? And the world has a soul. There is a world soul. It's an interesting discussion in Plotinus about whether all souls are one soul. You know, like, and he kind of goes back and forth on that view. He kind of takes a both-and view, you know, like, about that. But the realm of the soul, the human soul, is the capacity to understand and approach the one. The human capacity to do that is based on soul. And that is what the soul is in a human being, like this capacity to approach the one. Oh, and he does refer to the one, incidentally, as God. Like, he does use that word. And then even farther out, it's not a hypostasis or an emanation, but even further out is matter. So that's the basic structure, these three emanations. You know, you have the one, I mean, there are three emanations, the central one, the central oneness, and then the first emanation of the intelligible, and then the second emanation of the soul, and the third emanation into matter. Now, what's interesting about that is that system is very foreign to a modern way of looking at things. It was not foreign at all to the late Roman Empire. What you have for Plotinus is you have some things are more real than other things. So the most real thing is the one. Less real, but still extremely real, is the realm of nous, and the realm of pure forms. I'm not sure where, incidentally, angels and that kind of thing, fit in, but I think they're in the nous. Yeah.
If you think of the Pythagorean Tetractus, you see that this is a symbol that has it all already shown in there. So you have the one at the top, and then the level of two, the first dyad, which is the form, and then the three underneath that is the soul, and then the final layer is the
is matter.
So yeah, I'm sure.
Okay. What John is referring to is a triangle series of numbers. So you have a single circle, and then you divide that in two. And then you have 1, 2, 3, and then you have circles 1, 2, 3, 4 in a pyramid. Okay. So it's called Tetractus. And so you have the one at the top, and then you have the one many, which has become two, And then you have, which is the a symbol of nous. And then you have the three, which is a symbol of the soul. And then you have the four, which is the material realm. So the farther you get from the one, the less real the entity is. I have found it helpful to look at it from the perspective of eternity, which is not a name that Plotinus uses that often, but I found it personally helpful. So if you think of the one as the eternal, and then you think of the intelligible realm, like numbers are really long-lasting. I mean, some mathematicians would say they are eternal. So you have this realm of pure forms, and then you have the soul, which is much more animate and much more fleeting and much more subject to change. And then you have the realm of matter in which all things are fleeting. And changing. Everything in the perceptual realm is changing and ephemeral. The odd thing is that actually reverses the modern view. The modern view is that ideas are insubstantial and unreal, and that the only real thing is sense perception. That's the view of a materialist cosmology. incidentally, this cosmology, which is called emanationism, is not, you won't find it in a telescope, and you won't, you know, it's not a geography, you know, like, it's a spiritual cosmology and depicts our relationship to a spiritual cosmos. So are there comments or about that cosmological arrangement? Because the purpose of philosophy, from Plotinus's point of view, is to return to the One. That's what they were trying to do at his school. In fact, that's what they were trying to do at all schools, Platonism.
Would it be a stretch to say that all of the other realms are contained in the One?
No, it wouldn't be a stretch. You could look at it that way. So think of the One as a fire. The farther you get away from the fire, the colder you are, and the more distant you are. And you might get so distant from the fire that you might not even believe that there is such a thing as warmth, you know, like or a source. Then think of all the things that are arranged around the fire as created by that fire, so that the distant things have actually forgotten, you know, like that their origin was in the fire itself.
So this also, remember, there's a mythological layer here that's not really, he doesn't have to be explicit about it, because everybody at those times knew about the mythological layer. So if you think of Helios, like the sun, as being this fire that you're talking about, like a symbol, and mm-hmm. how at the bottom of the ocean, the sun has a very difficult time penetrating, but still, there's still a relationship between, you know, the sun and the rays come out, the rays coming out are, like you mentioned, the logos or the realm of the forms, and then the atmosphere can be seen as soul. It's a buffering thing. It moves from between, it's not as substantial as matter, but it's not completely insubstantial like the logos. So the atmosphere is like this, the world soul, it buffers, and then, you know, the world of material forms already is interacting with the light, the what's coming from the sun, already mediated through several quote-unquote layers of emanation. So what we are receiving has already been filtered many, many times. And that's,
thank you.
I hope that helps.
There are many, many images you can use to illustrate this.
I'm wondering what your comment would be on the following. I was on a panel on pagan deities, and throughout to them, my own experience, which was that two that I had encountered, were, I experienced as more real than I was.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I know this makes no sense, since this is reality, but that was the experience. And several others said, yes. How would that fit into the Plotinian?
Plotinus would completely agree with that. He would agree that deities are more real than human beings. Because they are closer to the One. Right? You can actually refine this series of concentric circles, into subdivisions. They're called hypostases, I believe. The three concentric circles, are kind of the beginning view of what it means. But Plotinus would have completely agreed with that. What's interesting to me about Plotinus, and one of the reasons why I think that his thought could have a healing effect on our world, if his thought could be re-injected into the culture, is that his view of the world is not negative. I mean, it's interesting, that the world depends for its, the world of sense experience depends on the One. It is an emanation of the One, and is also therefore a doorway to the one. What I understand from Plotinus is that it takes a shift of awareness to sort of see sensory experience as an emanation of the one. And then you can use that sensory experience to ascend to the one. But if you are attached to sensory experience, like if you, or if you think that sensory experience is all that there is, then you get lost, like, and you forget what the source is.
It's a little bit like Vajrayana Buddhism.
It does, doesn't it? There's, you know, like...
It's similar, even language is forgiven.
Uh-huh. It's also quite close to some Brahmanical thought, you know, like, from what I've read.
Yeah. Most Brahmanical thought, though, puts down the sense experience as opposed to incorporating it as
right.
a path.
Right, right.
Whereas the Tantric or Vajrayana... incorporated.
Like well, it's interesting. I mean, Plotinus has a very interesting balance. He himself was an ascetic, like, and he recommends asceticism, you know, like in his Enneads, you know, like in the sense of to not get lost, you know, like to sort of turn away from sense experience. But this the turn away is not a condemnation of sense experience. It's a kind of it's an interesting balance, and it's not easy to achieve. You know, like, you know, the tendency is to want to, if you're turning away, the reason you're turning away is because it's disgusting and repulsive, and, you know, like that kind of thing. But that's not what he's getting at. It's sort of like, if you're learning music, let's say you're learning the piano, you got to play your scales. The scales are a gateway to becoming a musician. You know, like, and you know, like, if you, you know, like, you, in a way, you have to realize that the scales are just a step on the path to becoming a musician. But you can't ignore them. It's not that they're bad. It's not that they're repulsive. It's not that they're, you know, like, something that should be done away with, you know, like. But on the other hand, if all you do is play scales for the rest of your life, you haven't, you know, realized the potential of being a musician. That's a rough analogy of trying to get that balance, you know, like Plotinus. To me, Plotinus has the potential of healing the divide between the immanentists and the transcendentalists, you know, like. He definitely believes in a transcendental reality, the one. Right? And he definitely believes that the world of sense experience is lesser than the one, and that the goal of human life should be to return to the one. But he doesn't believe that the world of sense experience is valueless. You know, like, and so it's a very interesting... If you only read certain passages in Plotinus, you'll think, man, this guy is a world negator, you know, like. But there are other passages you read and you think, oh, this is a typical pagan, you know, like, and the world has a soul, and the, you know, like, and is speaking to us, and he actually believes the earth has a soul. You know, like, I say actually because it's unusual to run into Dick, you know, like, but you know, like, but he's quite clear about that. You know, like, that there is a soul to the world, you know, like, and it's really quite beautiful, you know, like, how he'll, so, if somebody quotes a passage of Plotinus from you, you know, keep that balance in mind. You really need to have a broad reading of his thought in order to get that sense of a scope, you know, like, that he's covering.
I was gonna say that what I remember when I was writing about how capitalism developed in the West, and he was an important part of it because he's one who, in a sense, stated that grace is expressed through matter, and then as time went on, matter became a vehicle of grace. afterwards. And then you get later into the prosenethic and spirit of capitalism and all that, you start to make that connection that it's the whole thing gets switched. He talks about the one, and that these what we see in matter is a reflection of the one, and then later on it becomes matter is actually the end point, and it is a vehicle of this, and then we become enamored with material. That's a big difference in our capitalistic, because it was an aspect of Protestant ethics.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So, that's what I remember about it.
I'd like to take a few moments and just give you an example from one particular essay, so you get a flavor of his writing. And this is the sixth essay from the first Ennead, and it's called On Beauty. And it opens this way. Beauty addresses itself chiefly to sight, but there is a beauty for hearing too, as in certain combinations of words and in all kinds of music, for melodies and cadences are beautiful, and minds that lift themselves above the realm of sense to a higher order are aware of beauty in the conduct of life, in actions, in character, in the pursuits of the intellect, and there is the beauty of the virtues. What loftier beauty there may be, our argument will bring to light. So here in the opening, what he's doing in the opening is very helpful. He's giving examples of things that we think of as beautiful. So a beautiful sight, like a beautiful sunset. But then there is beauty in hearing too, like a beautiful poem, beautiful melody. And then there's also beautiful conduct. You know, wasn't it beautiful the way Sam helped out, you know, like when no one would step up, you know, Sam went there, and wasn't that beautiful the way he did that? You know, like we use that word, you know, like in actions and character. So what he's doing there is he's listing a series of things that we would all think of as beautiful, and the question emerges, what is it that they share? Like, if he just used visual things or just used sonic things, we might think that what is beautiful is the sound, or what is beautiful is the sight. But he's asking us to see the commonality in all these different beautiful things, and that will take us, that will lead us into a different realm of understanding. Well, like it helps us shift away from the sense experience, not in the sense of negating that sense experience, but expanding our awareness so that that sensory experience is included in something larger. I'm not going to go through the whole thing. What I'm going to do is just read certain passages. You know, like, so later he says, our interpretation is that the soul, by the very truth of its nature, by its affiliation to the noblest existence in the hierarchy of being, when it sees anything of that kin or any trace of that kinship, thrills with an immediate delight, takes its own to itself, and thus stirs anew to the sense of its nature in all of its affinity. So what he's describing here is our recognition of the beautiful is a kind of resonance of the beauty of our own soul. And that's actually, you know, there's a resonance going on, and that's what we're experiencing. That's what makes the experience so delightful. You know, like, there's a kind of internal resonance that's going on. You know, like, we hold that all the loveliness of this world, isn't that a beautiful phrase? I mean, like, he's not a world negator, like when you can write a phrase like that. We hold that all the loveliness of this world comes by communion in the ideal form, in the ideal form of beauty, which is an emanation of the One. So we are communing. When we see something beautiful, it resonates with the beauty of our own soul, and we commune with that ideal form, which is in the nous.
But we become familiar with it.
Yes.
Because it's already there in us.
Right.
Right, yeah.
Later, Plotinus says, thus, for an illustration, there is beauty conferred by craftsmanship of a house with all its parts, and the beauty which some natural quality may give to a single stone. I love that passage. There is a beauty in the agreement of a house with all its parts. That is, there are beautiful houses, and that you can find that same beauty in a single stone. I mean, to me, this is Plotinus at its best. He takes something from the human realm, he takes something from the natural realm, and then he unites them in this experience of the beautiful.
So that's our soul connecting with the soul of the stone.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Which ultimately is the same thing.
And harmonies unheard in sound create the harmonies we hear and wake the soul to consciousness of beauty, showing it the one essence in another kind. That is to say, harmonies of sound show us the essence that is beauty in a kind that is different from our own soul, different type of object. For the measures of our sensible music are not arbitrary, but are determined by the principle whose labor is to dominate matter and bring pattern into being. But there are earlier and loftier beauties than these. In the sense-bound life, we are no longer granted to know them. But the soul, taking no help from the organs, sees and proclaims them. To the vision of those, we must leave sense to its own place. So he's saying the experience, as we move up, becomes more and more refined and more difficult to express. These lovers, then, lovers of beauty outside of sense, must be made to declare themselves. So he's urging people who have this experience to declare their experience. I think that's interesting. Don't keep it to yourself. Let people know.
Even though it's ineffable.
Even though it's ineffable. I mean, that really, one of the great paradoxes of the Platonic tradition, Plato also believed in the existence of the ineffable. I mean, he's not as explicit about it as Plotinus, but in his seventh letter and in Phaedrus, incidentally behind this essay on beauty in the Enneads, are two dialogues of Plato, the Phaedrus and the Symposium, are both woven, or are foundational for it. I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. That's all right.
It was a beautiful train.
Thank you. What do you feel in presence of the grace you discern in actions, in manners, in sound morality, in all the works and fruits of virtue, in the beauty of souls? So here he's once again, he's shifting. He did houses and stones, music, and now he's returning to the a beautiful soul manifesting in certain kinds of action. So it's interesting to me that he doesn't separate actions from the soul.
You and I had a conversation a while ago, and I threw out an idea. I wondered how it would fit a Platonian approach that love was the perception of inner beauty.
He does link that. You know, there are essays on love in here, and he does talk about beauty in that context. So in a way, you could say that beauty and love and oneness and that kind of thing are different facets of the jewel that lies at the center. You know, you could kind of that's one metaphor. They don't exclude each other, but they are ways of approaching to the one. All that proceeds from intellection, and this is the nous, what I call the intelligible, all that proceeds from intellection are the soul's beauty, a graciousness that is native to it and not foreign. For only with these is it truly soul. And it is just to say that in the soul's becoming a good and beautiful thing is its becoming like to God. For whom the divine comes all the beauty and all the good in all beings. So in Orthodox theology, there is a process called theosis, where you, through certain practices, you actually become, you take on certain qualities of God. You don't become God, but you take on certain qualities of God. You are transformed, you know, by these qualities. That's what Plotinus is talking about, I think. And that's one of the strongest influences that he has had on Western thought. You know, that taking on these qualities transforms you in an inner manner. But what must we do? How lies the path? How come to vision of the inaccessible beauty, dwelling as if in consecrated precincts, apart from the common ways where all may see, even the profane? He that has strength, let him arise and withdraw into himself, forgoing all that is known by the eyes, turning away, for even from the material beauty that once made his joy. So what he's talking about is turning inward. The experience of the beauty and the soul lies within. The good which lies beyond is the fountain at once and principle of beauty. The good which lies within is the fountain at once and principle of beauty. The primal good and the primal beauty have the one dwelling place, and thus always beauty's seat is there. That's the last line. That's how he closes it. So the good and the beautiful, and I think love as well, are one, ultimately. But I would suggest that Plotinus' view is that human beings are not capable of understanding that oneness intellectually. And so we are in a position where we have to speak of the beautiful, or we have to speak of the one, or we have to speak of the good, or we have to speak of love. What do you think, gang? So, for me, Plotinus, reading Plotinus is itself a kind of experience of the beautiful. Like, spiritual, to me, this is what spiritual reading is about. Reading can be a spiritual practice. Like, reading itself can be a spiritual practice. If we understand the reading as a door, like a stone, or a beautiful house, or a sunset, to this realm. And I think that what that requires bracketing the tendency of our mind to read things. John introduced me to this term. We have to bracket the hermeneutics of suspicion. So if we...
Say it again, the what?
The hermeneutics of suspicion. So the critical mind approaches a text with, I'm going to get you. I'm going to find, you know, what you really are talking about. And what you're really talking about is, you know, like power, politics, you know, like this, that, the other. And lo and behold, if that's your approach, you're going to find it. Like, you're going to... and it's really deadly to reading spiritual texts. But it's very pervasive in our culture. And it's good to be conscious of it. We've inherited that tendency. Not from any specific individual. There may be some cases where somebody has actually been taught the hermeneutics of suspicion, but there's a general kind of cynicism, and it's completely understandable. Editorials are filled with it, politicians daily, we're always reading between the lines, what are they really getting at? What are they really, doing? To read Plotinus, my paradigm for reading something like Plotinus is to read Plotinus in the way that I listen to music. With the mind that I have when I listen to music. The analogy has its flaws because words are different than music, and I get that. But I also think that intuitively you might understand what I'm saying. So if I was listening to a piece of music, here's the story. Mozart and Haydn were very good friends. So Haydn had a premiere of a string quartet, and Mozart was in the audience, and there was this guy next to him who was going, I would not have done that. No. And then there were a few more bars, and it's like, oh gosh, that progression, I would not have done that. It was going, and finally, Mozart turned to him and said, no, you would not have. So the guy who was standing next to Mozart had the hermeneutics of suspicion with regard to Haydn's music, and he couldn't hear it. He couldn't hear the music. If you're always there with this sort of combative, sort of tendency. And like I say, it's understandable because every day we're given information and text where we have to be on guard. In advertising, in political discourse, and it sets up a habit of mind, which is actually quite strong. In order to read a spiritual text, you need to kind of center down and take a breath. And when Plotinus says something that you disagree with, just relax and say, he sees it this way. I don't see it that way. And move on. In other words, you don't have to enter into combat. I'm not saying that you have to agree with everything Plotinus says. It's not actually a matter of agreeing or disagreeing. It's a matter of being open and receptive.
Seems like it takes less energy to
It's much more relaxing. It's quite refreshing.
It's like Plotinus himself, that his tolerance
yes.
of all the perspectives that you embraced, or,
yeah.
or the style you were talking about, yeah. how he explicates an idea he doesn't really think is satisfactory, and then
right.
goes to the trouble of doing that.
Right.
And then goes on to something else.
He's very fair. To the people, you know, like he disagrees with. He takes considerable time to elaborate, you know, their perspectives so that the reader or presumably the listener, you know, would have a fair understanding of what someone else's view is. So that's a good point, you know. So
there's an aspect of, I think, in the modern world, especially around opinions and agreeing, mm-hmm. disagreeing,
mm-hmm.
and yet when we go to something like music or to a, you know, a museum, an art museum, we go and look at a painting. We don't sit and say, "Do we agree with the painting?" The painting either resonates with us,
mm-hmm.
and parts of it might not, but other parts do. It seems to me it's the same. When I read this kind of thing, is it resonating with something, mm-hmm. or is it not? And sometimes. That first reaction of "I don't agree with that" is actually when something's getting hit down
yeah,
deep.
That's a good point.
It's just a good yeah. indicator that
yeah,
yeah something yeah. of ego is coming up there that I should be aware of.
When I talk about reading Plotinus with the mind that I have when I listen to music, partly what I mean is that musical statements are neither true nor false, but they are meaningful.
Mm.
There's a dimension to Plotinian thought which is meaningful in that way. So I already mentioned about Plotinus today. I wanted to, I kind of jumped ahead, but I think his thought is a rich resource for what I talked about, the transcendental versus the immanent view of existence. I think he strikes a balance without eliminating either. You know, like it's kind of remarkable, really. You know, like how he's able to do that. And I think that's one of his great gifts, one among many. You know, like. The final suggestion I have about reading Plotinus is to read it slowly. The Enneads, there are 9 Enneads, and the Enneads are divided into sections by modern scholars. And some of the Enneads are quite short. I think the shortest one is only 2 sections long. Well, it's less than 2 pages. You know, like, and the longest Ennead is 45 sections long. And it's what I would call a treatise, you know, like. But the thing is, when I read Plotinus, I just read one section. I don't read a whole Ennead. You know, like, I just read one section. Like, the sentences that I read, you know, like, that's enough to digest. You know, like, that's enough to sort of ponder and contemplate. You know, like, and so if you are interested in reading Plotinus, I actually worked out a 2-year reading program for Plotinus in order to... I know. This is my...
I'm sure you did.
Yeah, this is habitual with me. I do this. You know, like, so that I just read one section, you know, at a time. And not necessarily every single day, you know, like, but... And then contemplate it.
I just wanted to say that, you know, Plotinus is like this one philosopher that's been so hugely influential,
mm-hmm.
in maybe not in the everyday circles, but if you look at you know, we have books of Ficino here, and you know, Ficino was in a way you could call him not a popularizer of Plotinus, not in that pejorative sense, but with him, you know, you have Plotinus being so influential in Western art and literature. I mean, people like in the 19th century, you know, the Symbolist movement, poets like William Butler Yeats, writers like
Yeats
Miller.
Yeats was very fond of Plotinus.
I mean, these are people who Vladimir Solovyov, these people just drank deeply from the wellspring of Plotinus, and this is recent. I mean, these are artistic and literary movements of the last 150 years or so. So I think Plotinus is he's been making a comeback since the 1400s.
Yeah, so. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting about Plotinus. For he had a huge influence on emerging Christianity, on the Jewish tradition. Philo of Alexandria is clearly in sync with Plotinian thought and Islam as well. But Plotinus's Enneads were not translated into English until the late 1800s. Isn't that interesting? You know, like the first translation was by Guthrie, and it remained pretty much locked in academic circles. Didn't get, you know, published far and wide. Then McKenna, this is the McKenna translation, in the early 20th century translator, and he did translate it for a major publisher and a wide audience. So it's really only in the 20th century. Oh, and there's a third translation by Armstrong, which was in the 1980s, I think, something like that, for the Loeb Classical Library. So there's three complete English translations, and there are numerous translations of individual Enneads by various authors. But in a way, he's only entered into the English-speaking world in the last 150 years, which I find remarkable. But I also think it's a wonderful thing. I like that, in a way, I think we're just seeing the first glimpses of the kind of influence that that he could have. I want to thank everybody, you know, like, for coming tonight. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate the comments and people have any closing comments they want to make or observations?
Thank you, Jim.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Jim.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And thank you on behalf of Many Rivers, of course. And thank you all for coming tonight. We have our donation bowl over there, as usual. And as you can see, we have a raft of books relevant. And in fact, even, I don't know if Microcosmos has much to do with Plotinus, but it does perhaps in the sense that there, I'm sure, is a resonance for some readers in the way that Jim was talking about Plotinus having resonance for readers. So anyway, there's a whole raft of things over there to look at, and once again, looking forward to seeing you all again here at Many Rivers.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.